This week on Vanderbilt Internal Medicine Podcast, it is our last recording with the Chiefs.
Hey friends, I'm excited and can't believe it is the end of the year.
Ah, Dr. Stone was talking about Berger's disease.
Ultimately, they arrived to the diagnosis of drug-induced aseptic meningitis. And I want to leave you guys with one final limerick.
This podcast is made by and for our internal medicine residents to enhance our educational experience. The content, while edited by residents, is not verified by host speakers, and we are not content experts on these topics. The content provided by this podcast is not intended and should not be construed as medical advice. It should not be used to diagnose or treat any medical condition. We attempt to avoid use of opinion, but all opinions are our own and not representative of the University Medical Center. Please keep this in mind as you enjoy our podcast.
Welcome back to the Vanderbilt Internal Medicine Podcast.
Casey, it is our last recording with the Chiefs.
Doesn't feel real.
It doesn't. I mean, we've been doing this for 2 years and have enjoyed the heck out of it. It didn't ever seem like this day would come.
The podcast will go on.
It will. And we're really excited to announce the new folks soon. But for the time being, we're here recording with Lee for one final session.
Lee, do you have any parting wisdom for us other than the upcoming cases we're about to talk about?
Hey friends, I'm excited and can't believe it is the end of the year. I've enjoyed talking with you guys throughout the year about approaching different problems, and I know the residents have heard me harp over and over again about the importance of a problem representation, as well as developing a diagnostic schema or a framework for approaching problems. So I hope that's one of the big takeaways that you've learned throughout this year in listening to me talk way too verbosely about some of these topics. But I'm going to bring you some more of that content today, so I can't wait to talk about these awesome cases.
Well, let's jump right into the first case. I heard it's a mystery.
All right, I'm excited to get this rolling. So I do have to ask you a question, though. Are you a big bettor? Do you consider yourself a betting person?
I am a very big bettor.
I love it. Yeah, so I am usually not. But this time of year, I really get into it because last weekend was the Kentucky Derby. And so always love betting on the ponies, watching that with family and friends growing up. And because I was in a betting mood at Morning Report last week, I actually called out one of our second year residents and made a bet with him, Robbie Grad. And so I said, Robbie, if you can get this diagnosis correct, just based off the chief complaint, I will buy you and your team a Chick-fil-A breakfast the following day.
Those were high stakes.
They were really high stakes. I won't be able to buy you Chick-fil-A, but I'll give you some Laffy Taffy that's over in the bag there. So I just want to give you this chief complaint and see what you think. It was a 36-year-old male with blue fingers. And how about if I give you a Dr. Stone limerick to help you out with your guess? Just because you're a third year. Robbie didn't need this crutch, but I'll help you out with it. And so here's the limerick from good Dr. Stone. Distal ischemia, digits selected, male smokers in their 40s affected. Inflammation markers absent, large ulcers may be present. Quitting smoking will never be regretted. So based on that?
Ah, Dr. Stone was talking about Berger's disease.
Thromboangiitis obliterans, which Robbie obliterated and got totally correct. So I owed he and his team Chick-fil-A breakfast the next day. He helped really generate an awesome differential for this case because it's not just about nailing the right diagnosis, but it's about the thought process.
Tell us a little bit about how the typical patient with Berger's disease would present.
Yeah, definitely. The epidemiology is interesting and classic in that we learn a lot of these things as buzzwords in medical school. So middle-aged men, for example, people with a past history of smoking, those are the top two things that will initially come to mind. Patients oftentimes will also present with bluish discoloration of their digits that may eventually progress to ulceration.
What teaching points did you get out of this and what sort of approach did you take toward it?
So I asked the group two questions. I said, how do you all think about ulcers? And how do you all think about blue fingers? No one really had seen that before or thought through a diagnostic tree for it, which I hadn't really either. And so we came up with a system ourselves, which I wanted to share with you. And so we actually had two different approaches. And one of them references the mechanisms that lead to ulceration in many cases. And I have to give a shout out to Evan Schwartz, because this is actually based on a teaching he did at a Morning Report a couple of weeks prior. And then the second approach we used was actually thinking through the underlying stages of wound healing and how perturbations in that process may actually manifest in ulcers. So I'm going to go into Evan's approach first. And so Evan referenced this review article from the New England Journal of Medicine that looked at the evaluation and management of lower extremity ulcers. And what it did is it divided ulcer types into really four broad categories in the lower extremity. Ulcers due to venous issues, ulcers due to arterial issues, ulcers due to neuropathic diabetic disease, and then pressure ulcers as well. And so if you look in each of those categories, you can actually think through why a certain ulcer presents in the way it does, and also in the location that it does. So for example, in venous disease with venous ulcers, oftentimes the area between the lower calf and the medial malleolus is where it's affected. As opposed to arterial disease, you may see this more commonly in pressure points, as well as the distal parts of the toes and feet and the lateral malleolus. The ulcer characteristics can also differ. For example, in venous ulcers, they're often more shallow with flat margins and have a moderate to heavy exudate with slough at the base and granulation tissue. Whereas arterial ulcers have that more picturesque appearance with punched out, it's deep, irregular shaped, and just appears like an unhealthy wound bed overall.
So how do you use this approach to apply to the patient at hand?
Yes, so that's a great question. So let's talk through the differential we generated for this patient. So starting with arterial vessel issues, there are a number of things that we considered. For example, could this patient have had a thrombophilia or clots? And so we asked more history questions of Kaylee regarding the patient's family history, a personal history of clots. Someone else also brought up about their renal function before we saw labs because they were considering something like calciphylaxis. There can also be immunologic arterial issues, which is what we see with things like Raynaud's, scleroderma, and cryoglobulinemia. So we also considered infectious arterial causes, such as septic emboli to fingers related to endocarditis. So remember, that's part of the minor criteria of Duke's criteria. Those are Janeway lesions or hemorrhagic papules, which are different from the immunologic phenomena of painful ouch-ouch Osler nodes, which are secondary to immune complex deposition. Also with arterial problems, we considered a number of the vasculitides. So Berger's disease did come up, as did PAN, polyarteritis nodosa. Our other categories were a little smaller. So for venous, DVT was considered, but it seemed less likely as there wasn't true upper extremity swelling. Neuropathy or damaged proprioception was also considered, and the patient was checked for an A1C as well as B12, both of which were within normal limits, making those diagnoses less likely. And then finally, to round things out, we considered derm and skin issues, which also seemed less likely based on history, because there wasn't a personal physical history of injury, such as thermal injury, radiation exposure, chemical exposure. There are no new meds that could have brought this up, such as from warfarin skin necrosis or heparin-induced thrombocytopenia. And here in Tennessee, we also times will think about loxosalism with ulcerative diseases, but there was no known bites to brown recluse spiders.
Lee, you prefaced this all by mentioning also that you all discussed wound healing. Tell us a little bit more about that.
Yeah, so I think this was a second way that you can think through approaching this case as well, because in addition to the chief complaint of the blue fingers, the patient had ulcers on physical exam as well. And so we talked a little bit about the healing mechanism with ulcers, and I referenced my third year med school surgery rotation, where I had an old school surgeon who talked a lot about the wound healing process and the four stages of wound healing. I must admit I had a little bit of a brain fart and didn't recall them immediately, so shout out to Adesola and Maddie. But the four stages of wound healing include hemostasis, the inflammatory phase, proliferative phase, and the maturation phase.
Where are we going with this?
So I know you're excited to dive into the specifics, but stick with me just for a second because it makes sense clinically. And so akin to the phases of reopening, which I'm very excited that we're doing here in Nashville, let's talk about the phases of wound healing as well, because slow and steady wins the race, just like with reopening Nashville. So phase one of wound healing is hemostasis, which makes a lot of sense. The wound closes by clotting. You get local blood vessel constriction with the development of primary and secondary hemostasis. So this goes back to that platelet plug formation, and eventually you get platelet adhesion, activation, and aggregation. And if you understand and think through this, it makes sense where, for example, if you have a patient who's on a P2Y12 inhibitor, that they're taking clopidogrel, then you know that that's going to inhibit platelet activation, one of the underlying parts of this process, which then may lead to poor wound healing overall. The following stages of wound healing include the inflammatory phase. This is the localized acute and then chronic inflammation that creates the Latin lyrics of healing, as my pathology teacher said back in med school. So this is the calor, or the heat, the rubor, the redness, dolor, pain, and tumor, and swelling that you see with inflammation. Then the third is the proliferative phase, where the wound is rebuilt with new tissue made of collagen and extracellular matrix, where the wound contracts as new tissues are built, and angiogenesis occurs as granulation tissue needs to receive oxygen and nutrients in order to heal well. And then the maturation or the remodeling phase is the final phase. And this is where collagen is remodeled from type 3 to type 1 and the wound fully closes. And so if you understand that entire process, you may understand a little bit better why each of your individual patients don't have healing wounds.
So we've covered a lot here, the four different types of ulcers, the four stages of wound healing. How does this all apply to our patient? What's going on in Berger's disease that this patient is getting ulcers and not healing wounds?
Yes, so we know Berger's disease or thromboangitis obliterans is a vasculitis. So if you actually do take a look at the blood vessels, there's an inflammatory infiltrate in the blood vessels. However, we don't have a great understanding of all of the underlying pathophysiology. We do know it's a non-atherosclerotic, segmental, inflammatory, occlusive vascular disease that mostly affects small and medium-sized vessels. And despite the strong association with tobacco, the role of smoking in the pathogenesis is really unknown. We discussed some of the epidemiologic factors earlier, which includes middle-aged men, oftentimes in their 30s or 40s, with current or recent use of tobacco. And it often presents with distal extremity ischemia, as well as some ulcerations in both the upper and lower extremity. And it oftentimes is a diagnosis of exclusion as well. You have to exclude other autoimmune diseases, thrombophilia, diabetes, as well as proximal embolic sources.
We know it's a diagnosis of exclusion, but how do we treat Berger's disease?
Early studies in Berger's disease elucidated that smoking cessation was key to the pathogenesis, and as long as you stopped, you oftentimes could see improvement in the disease. So Kaylee mentioned at the end that she ended up putting this patient on Chantix, and so someone was curious why they weren't placed on nicotine replacement therapy. So she was able to teach that a New England Journal of Medicine review stated that nicotine replacement therapy may keep the disease active. And this was actually based on two small studies which were performed in the late 80s and early 90s. Now, she was able to cite a small prospective study in 2006 that looked at 27 patients examining smoking characteristics and cessation in patients with Berger's disease. And in that small cohort, there's actually no relationship between long-term tobacco abstinence and type of pharmacologic treatment, as well as disease activity. And so there wasn't a big association with you take nicotine replacement therapy and you have a higher activity of disease. It makes sense if you actually think through the physiology mechanistically why nicotine's role could be negative in this disease process. Nicotine is a neurotransmitter that I like to think of as being sprinkled on the nicotinic acetylcholine receptors in the periphery. So this is on the postganglionic sympathetic nerve endings. And so what does this do with the sympathetic nerve system? Lead to vasoconstriction. So it makes sense that if you're giving someone nicotine and you might activate the sympathetic nervous system, you may actually get more peripheral vasoconstriction, thus more manifestation of the disease.
Well, bringing it back to the original pathophysiology, that's a great learning point.
Yeah. Aren't you glad you paid attention to physiology in med school? This is why IM and peds are the best, in my opinion. All right, is your brain spinning in circles yet?
Not quite yet.
It's all good because we're going to talk about the brain
a little bit
here with our next two cases. These were two awesome cases that were presented by Dr. Dunn and Dr. Tai, two future cardiologists that are going to be heading to Cleveland Clinic and out west to UCLA next year. Both of them actually talked about cases of meningitis, so I'm excited to share a little bit about both of these with you.
Well, let's talk about Robert's case first.
This was a patient who presented with meningitis and had a lot of the classic signs and symptoms of it, but interestingly reported that they were admitted to the hospital 4 months ago and also diagnosed with meningitis. And something that they teased out on history is that she had recently been given Bactrim for a UTI by her father, who was a physician. So lesson number one is don't treat your family members. But lesson number two is always take a good med history, which I was really proud to see Robert and his team did. And ultimately, they arrived to the diagnosis of drug-induced aseptic meningitis.
Interesting. That's something I really don't know much about.
I did not know anything about it either until Robert gave this case. And it's just as it sounds, where you do get an inflammatory pleocytosis of the meninges, of the CSF, that is due to drugs. And so typical causes are NSAIDs, antimicrobials, as well as IVIG. and it actually does have an association with underlying autoimmune diseases. And the CSF oftentimes will have a PMN predominance with an elevated protein and a normal glucose. But it's important to mention that this is a diagnosis of exclusion. So you have to be looking for more common causes of meningitis. The actual confirmation of this diagnosis actually requires a drug challenge, which in the literature doesn't always happen, particularly in patients that have a very impressive presentation. The treatment is oftentimes supportive.
So it's a diagnosis of exclusion, but what actually causes this?
So the mechanism of drug-induced meningitis requires us to revisit why adverse drug reactions occur. There are type A and type B reactions. This is actually a type B reaction. But first, for type A reactions, these are predictable and normal individuals. It's based on the mechanism of action of the drug and is dose dependent. So the example he gave is NSAIDs causing GI bleed, where it makes sense given the underlying mechanism of action and in high doses why NSAIDs would cause a GI bleed. However, drug-induced meningitis falls into the type B reactions, which is unpredictable in susceptible individuals. This can be both immune and non-immune related. And so it's thought that drug-induced meningitis is immune-related as part of a drug hypersensitivity reaction. This is different from the non-immune-related type B reactions, which is what we see with idiosyncratic reactions, for example, dapsone and G6PD, or an exaggerated hypersensitivity, which occurs in tinnitus with small aspirin doses, for example.
You mentioned hypersensitivity reactions. You know, that gets me thinking about all the different types. Are we going to talk about that?
Yes, I think it's important to cover those briefly because it's felt that Bactrim-induced meningitis actually shares features of both a type 4 hypersensitivity reaction as well as possibly a type 2 or type 3 hypersensitivity reaction. And so just to quickly cover over those, type 1 hypersensitivity is due to an immune reactant with IgE, and the effector cell there is mast cell activation. Type 2 hypersensitivity reactions are with IgG. And these are cell or matrix-associated antigens. Whereas type 3 hypersensitivity reactions is actually due to immune complex development. It also is with IgG, but it's what we see in things like serum sickness or the arthritis reaction. And then type 4, or the more delayed hypersensitivity reaction, actually can play out with a number of effector cells. There are sub-classifications of the type 4 hypersensitivity reaction. Bactrim-induced meningitis have features of both type 4 hypersensitivity because you can have reactions without a prior exposure and you oftentimes will see positive patch testing. But there's also elements of a type 2 and type 3 hypersensitivity reaction because the CSF fluids is often filled with immune complexes and then subsequent exposures have a faster onset.
What should I be on the lookout for in these patients? I mean, how can they present? I would imagine it's a rather mild illness compared to bacterial meningitis, but I don't really know.
So that's what I thought as well, but actually there's a myriad of presentations one can expect to see with this because it can be pretty mild, as you mentioned, but it can also lead to fulminant disease and possibly death.
Lee, you mentioned that Warren had a patient with a similar presentation as well, didn't you?
He did. So he had a patient who also presented altered with a fever as well as with positive meningeal signs, and so was ultimately diagnosed with HSV encephalitis.
Lee, I'm always excited to talk about ID topics. Can you give us a little bit of background before we get started?
Absolutely. So HSV encephalitis accounts for 10 to 20% of the viral encephalitis cases in the United States each year. It really can affect all age groups, but around a third of the cases are in children and adolescents. HSV-1 accounts for about 90% of the cases. And when we think back to the underlying pathophysiology, patients often will have a primary infection of oral or cutaneous on mucosal surfaces, which the virus actually remains dormant or latent in the trigeminal ganglion. And with reactivation, it can actually travel retrograde and infect the brain, most commonly the temporal lobe.
I know that when we are concerned about a bacterial meningitis, the first thing we need to think about are starting antibiotics. Is it the same with HSV encephalitis?
Yes, so I'm glad you brought this up because there's actually quite a bit of evidence that early initiation of acyclovir therapy improves outcomes. Even despite that, delays in initiation of treatments are commonly reported. There was a European retrospective multicenter study that involved over 400 patients. Only 45% of patients with HSV encephalitis were treated within 48 hours after the onset of symptoms.
Did you say 45%?
45%.
Ooh. Yeah. Okay.
And there was a U.S. study, which was in 2006, in which only 29% of patients ultimately diagnosed with HSV encephalitis received acyclovir while in the ED, despite clinical presentations consistent with viral encephalitis.
That seems like such a high percentage. Why do you think there's such a delay in treatment for this disease?
So I think there could be a few reasons, but the ultimate take-home teaching point is that we need to really have a high suspicion for HSV encephalitis if we're considering any viral encephalitis or meningitis on our differential diagnosis.
What's the prognosis?
Yeah, so I mentioned earlier some of the data regarding delayed treatment. However, even with appropriate diagnosis and treatment, there's a really high mortality of up to 20 to 30%. Untreated, however, there's a 70% mortality, and those survivors have very serious neurologic deficits. They can have long-lasting neuro effects, including significant cognitive impairment, anterograde amnesia, as well as features of Kluver-Busey syndrome. They oftentimes will manifest as well with dysnomia, or difficulty to find the right words, and impaired new learning.
Can we get a refresher on what Kluver-Busey syndrome is, please?
Yes, I had to refresh myself as well. This is a neurologic syndrome where you get a loss of normal anger and fear responses, hyperorality, as well as increased sexual activity. So again, as I mentioned earlier, there can be some serious sequelae with this disease. So you need to have a high index of suspicion and a low threshold to initiate acyclovir therapy very early on if you're considering this diagnosis.
Lee, how does it feel?
Alex, Casey, it's the end of the year.
It's the end of the year.
I can't believe it. The year has flown by. Even though it's been long at times, it has been a lot of fun. I've really enjoyed and loved working with the residents. And most importantly, I've loved the squares.
Never skip waffle day.
Never skip waffle day. French toast day on Wednesdays on point. I've become a big fan of Friday breakfast, which includes the sausage gravy.
Do you still get the squares as a fellow?
I'm gonna get the squares the rest of my life. No questions asked.
Lee, thanks so much for hanging out with us this year and for teaching us so much and covering morning reports. We know this is a big time commitment for you and you're already really busy, but our residents get a lot out of this podcast, so thank you so much.
Absolutely. It was my pleasure. I've really enjoyed it, and I want to leave you guys with one final limerick, if that's okay.
Of course.
Please.
Dr. Stone. This is my favorite one that he wrote of his 5 books, and this is called The Triad of Excellence. Address patient problems with intelligence. Attack your daily tasks with due diligence. Rare cases do us all enthrall, but remember most of all to treat each soul with awesome reverence. Thank you guys for a fun year.
Thanks, Lee.
Thanks, Lee. Aw.
And stay tuned for our next episode.